RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So to the newly released terms of reference to the Phase 2 COVID inquiry, are they fit for purpose? That's what we're getting into now. The Royal Commission of Inquiry into COVID Lessons Learned is looking at what can be learned from the pandemic to ensure that New Zealand is as prepared as possible for future pandemics in 2022. This is just a bit of a table setting exercise here. The government announced Phase 1 Lessons Learned from COVID-19 Pandemic Response. The purpose of Phase 1 was to strengthen New Zealand's preparedness for and response to future pandemics. Then there's Phase 2. Phase 2 must review the key decisions taken by government in New Zealand's response to COVID-19 during 2021 and 2022. I guess the key questions are these. Do we need this? I think I know the answer to that. And are the terms of reference fit for purpose? Linda Wharton is well known to us here at RCR. She's a naturopath, acupuncturist, and founder of the Health Forum NZ, and a tireless fighter, I would say. My words, Linda, thanks for coming back on RCR.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me here again.
Boy, it's been a long haul, hasn't it?
Oh, has it ever? Yeah, I've got to say energy levels, I think, across the board for all of us that were there from the beginning. We've gone from slow twitch to fast twitch, or is it the other way around, the way muscles work in marathons versus sprints?
Yeah.
I started out as a sprint, but I'm realizing it's a marathon. So,
well, if it's a slow twitch, it's going to become fast again, I think, as we get ready for this. So, okay, big picture. Are the terms of reference fit for purpose? Because there's one glaring thing missing for me. We can talk about that shortly, but an overview of the terms of reference first from you, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. So I guess for me personally, one of the biggest changes with Phase 2 is that finally we're allowed to use the words, well, the two words, vaccine efficacy, but more importantly for me, vaccine safety.
Yeah,
because Phase 1 of the inquiry studiously excluded talk of the vaccines, which I don't even like using those words.
No, neither do I. I don't like hearing them.
I call them mRNA products, but in the official documents about the inquiry, they're termed vaccines. So now, Phase 2, we have got new terms of reference that appear to focus on both vaccine safety and efficacy, and also mandates, as well as approval of specific vaccines, e.g. how and why did we end up with these products, and also looking at reporting and monitoring of adverse events. So there are other new terms looking around, you know, imposition and maintenance of lockdowns. But for me, the big, you know, the big mountain that we've been working so hard to climb to the top of is actually getting this in front of a Royal Commission of Inquiry, asking questions about safety and efficacy of the products.
That is going to be very awkward, isn't it, for many people? And I'm thinking of a few names, but many people, very awkward time, that bit.
I sincerely hope so. I really hope so, yes. I mean, you know, we're going to be, the beautiful thing about this, I was just ready for our talk today. I was reading a review article by Bell Gully, you know, the big
law firm,
and they were talking about the statutory powers of Royal Commissions of Inquiry. And something I hadn't realised is that they inherently have the power to summon any person to attend and give evidence, even against the wishes of the person, you know, they're summoned. So immediately I start thinking about one particular person who's currently offshore.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Beginning with the initial J, you know, can she be summoned to give evidence at this? And of course, Ashley Bloomfield, because we are talking about mandates. And when we talk about mandates, we can't possibly talk about that without also looking at the entire medical exemption system fiasco, which was headed by Ashley Bloomfield. So,
Anne Hipkins,
and of course Chris James as well, who's the group manager of MedSafe. I've been actually posting a few videos of him in the last week or so, doing some announcements around, you know, the provisional consent for the Pfizer. And what just has struck me so much is the discordance between his body language and his general demeanor, and everything about his body language and his breathing and his consistent gulping, and the discordance between that and the words he is speaking. So the words are telling New Zealand how safe and effective this product is, but his body language, and of course, the memos of the process behind the scenes also, you know, show us that he was having huge problems giving this even a provisional consent.
I've seen that. I know exactly what you're saying. It stands out. And the other thing we've learned also through Ursula Edgington is that MedSafe's sick leave has gone up by 650%. So,
oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, through OIAs, we know about that little fun fact. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, 650, not 50, not 100, 650%.
Oh, that's stunning.
Yeah, with a staff of 70. So there you go.
And I've seen similar OIAs looking at staff absenteeism in Health New Zealand, Te Whatu Ora. You know, nurses and doctors and everything in the public health system, the absenteeism is up hundreds of percent. I don't think it's up that high, but several hundred percent.
Yeah, so obviously a pattern there. Yeah. The one thing I mentioned at the start missing for me is the Pfizer contract. I want to know what we signed up to.
Yes, well, I wonder if that is going to be in the approval of specific vaccines section.
Maybe.
But of course, you know, based on our experience so far, despite repeated OIA applications by us and by many other parties in New Zealand asking for the release of the Pfizer contract, each and every one has been declined on the grounds of commercial sensitivity, confidentiality. Yeah. So it will be interesting to see whether the Royal Commission actually have the power, whether they have the legal power to override that. I don't know. It's a question for the lawyers that are listening.
Are you listening? Maybe you can text in with your response, 2057. I've been made aware that and I think I heard Peter McCullough talk about it first up, peer-reviewed Japanese study, Takada and colleagues, published just a month gone, August 2024, in the Journal of Infection and Chemotherapy, finding a 9.6 fatality rate among people who reported myocarditis and pericarditis after the mRNA COVID vaccine. Almost 10%, in other words, of those reporting heart damage post-vaccination died.
Yes. New study. I actually just posted about that this morning on X. What they did, the Japanese researchers, it's peer-reviewed study as well, which is gold standard. They investigated the Japanese equivalent to VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting, and they collated all of the data relating to pericarditis, myocarditis, and a combination of the two following mRNA injections specifically. And they tracked those cases for 62 days post-administration. And yeah, during that time, almost 10% of those cases died. And still to this day, the printed material and the online material relating to this extremely rare risk of myocarditis and pericarditis still tells us it's predominantly a mild and self-limiting condition.
Yeah.
Flies directly in the face of the new study.
The other thing in terms of exemptions that we've learned recently is that even though people had had adverse reactions to the first jab, they were not being, and these are bad reactions, they weren't being granted exemptions to stop the second one by Ashley Bloomfield himself. I just can't imagine the thinking behind that. I just can't get it.
No, it's well, it's something I've been banging on about ever since it was actually all in process during, you know, during the mandate period, because of course we were receiving hundreds and hundreds of emails from people actually enduring that process. So we had this bizarre dubbed a medical exemption system where, for example, the category of people that had a anaphylactic reaction to dose one, so they collapsed at the site of vaccination, whether it was in the hub or the pharmacy. A lot of them were actually taken to hospital in ambulances. Some of them spent 1 week in hospital recovering from that. It is a life-threatening event. And the vast majority of those people, we have the OIA information, but I haven't got it in front of me, sorry, Paul. The vast majority of those people were not granted an exemption from a second dose, even when Pfizer was the only product available. So this predated the availability of AstraZeneca and Novavax. So knowing that they had the anaphylaxis because of polyethylene glycol, which is the coating on the outside of the lipid nanoparticles, knowing that they were going to once again be exposed to PEG, Ashley Bloomfield declined a medical exemption. So they were then instructed to make a special booking for dose two at a public hospital or in an immunology clinic where there was life support systems, resus teams, and crash carts for dose two. And yes, believe it or not, some of those people did take dose two and did have another anaphylactic event. So I really hope that this is going to be cracked wide open in this phase two of the inquiry, because it does stand out for me in a literally in a huge array of illegal and immoral events. This one stands out for me as being incredibly cruel as well as medically negligent in every way.
Even if you're into self-preservation, Linda, I wouldn't want that on my hands.
Yeah.
You know, your intuitive response would be, go, whoa, okay, yeah, have an exemption, no problem, because I don't want that guilt, that whatever it is, on my hands or on my conscience. But
he
was different. He was okay with it.
Totally. And that was just anaphylaxis I was talking at. We also OIA'd looking at declined medical exemptions for people who had serious adverse events, myocarditis, pericarditis, cardiac arrest, and stroke on dose one. And again, many of those people did not get an exemption. And the ones that did get an exemption were given what were called temporary medical exemptions, which existed for a 3 to 6 month period, depending on what the initial event was. So the idea was that they recovered from the myocardial infarction or the cardiac arrest and then went for dose two. So a lot of people who were not mandated out of work, in that they took dose one, either willingly or unwillingly, they kept their jobs. A lot of those people had a serious adverse event with dose one and lost their jobs anyway because they couldn't get the exemption for dose two.
Yeah, dose two.
So there are just these multiple layers of incredible cruelty and complete overriding of traditional medical ethics in every way.
And just to finish on that one, I spoke to a doctor, I won't name who the doctor is. He told me he applied for over 100 exemptions on behalf of his patients, not one granted.
Yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me that that was the system. So these are the things that we sincerely hope under the section where they're going to be poking open the whole system of mandates. There's no way they can do that without also looking at the medical exemption system, as far as I can see.
Yeah. What about accountability that should follow? There's concern out there that, we'll know all about this, but who is held accountable? Who is punished? Because there needs to be punishment here, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't go around, you know, with a machete in the street and do this. So there has to be accountability and punishment. What's your feeling on that?
In my dream world, that would very much be the case. However, the terms of reference for both phase one and phase two do talk about this being a non-adversarial process that is a fact-finding mission to strengthen our next pandemic response. Having said that, once again, the Bell Gully article looking at statutory powers of Royal Commissions of Inquiry, they make a couple of interesting points. They state that, like I said before, the Royal Commission of Inquiry can summon any person to attend and give evidence. The Commission of Inquiry can also make findings of fault or recommend further steps be taken, including liability, so issuing of liability. And they also have the power to make awards or costs against any person. So I found that really interesting because it's only in the Bell Gully article that I have found that, because in the actual government terms of reference, they, of course, don't include that information, and they stress that this is more of a, you know, a constructive, collaborative, investigative process rather than a fault-finding mission.
Also, some recent news just dropped in the last day or so. I saw Kansas taking Pfizer to the courts, civil action. What do you know about that? And what do you think that means? Is that part of the another piece in the puzzle going in there?
Look, they're all pieces in the puzzle. And you know, I try and put as positive a spin on this as I can, partly to reinvigorate my own sense of hope to allow me to keep doing this work because it's tough yakka, as you know, Paul, as well. So yes, I find this hopeful that Kansas is leading the charge, but four other states in America, and I know you can ask me which four states, and I can't tell you off the top of my head, but now there are five states taking civil cases against Pfizer for misrepresentation and misleading advertising and statements relating to the Pfizer mRNA community product, the one that we used here in New Zealand. So it's going to be a really interesting process. Of course, Pfizer have, you know, unlimited billions of dollars to throw at their defense. But the fact that there are five states now litigating, I think, will add more weight to the, you know, the prosecution process.
I'm still seeing people saying, I took it, I'm okay. I don't know anyone else who's got a problem, and therefore everything's all right. That I'm sure will only stand for so long. How big do you think this impact will come to be understood? How big do you think it is? Because as it goes on, I keep thinking this is getting big. This is not stopping. This is bigger and bigger all the time. It's like an inflating balloon.
Every week, Paul, you know, there's a new televised press conference somewhere in the world or some new mainstream legacy media release in Japan in particular. They're doing quite a lot of stuff on mainstream news programs now talking about deaths and adverse events with the Pfizer in particular. So every week you think this is it. You know, I read a new peer-reviewed study and I just think there's just no way this continue after this. So what we are observing, I don't know that these products will ever be withdrawn from market because we're living in a changed paradigm, to be honest. But what we are observing is fewer and fewer people are still asleep and operating in the matrix. Fewer and fewer people, despite the reassurance of the New Zealand Ministry of Health and MedSafe, fewer and fewer people are willing to take the Pfizer mRNA. Having said that, we are still administering around 6,000 doses per week of dose 5 and above. So we're looking at a demographic of elderly people who are very much within the matrix, very much watching the 6 o'clock news, non-social media savvy, and still trusting the 6 o'clock news and the New Zealand government. outside of that, the younger demographic, they're disenfranchised not only with COVID mRNA, but increasingly with the entire paradigm of vaccination. And so I predict what we're going to see, and we're already seeing it in New Zealand and around the world, we're going to see a complete severing of faith in the public health system, and top of the pile, complete severing of faith and trust in vaccination. So the long-term implications of this, you know, stretching forward globally in terms of public health impact is going to be massive.
Yeah, if you were trying to stop vaccine hesitancy, nice job. That really worked out well, didn't it? You morons.
Not really.
Oh, dear. I've got a theory. I'll bounce it off you.
Yeah.
Because of the cycle of sickness now, and I mentioned MedSafe before, but that's many businesses, many enterprises. I had someone talking about a panel beater the other day. Couldn't get their car panel beated because all the staff are off sick. Curious. I think people who are sick all the time desperately try to do something to stop it, and that might get them into a cycle of continuous doses, continuous boosters. It's the only thing they can think of to do, you know? It's either that or face the cold, hard reality.
Yeah, and sadly, the fact that we're still administering 6,000 plus doses of dose 5 and above here in New Zealand, I would totally concur with you for that elder, you know, the older demographic are thinking exactly that. But I do believe that the younger demographic are saying, well, I've had two doses or three doses, and now I've had COVID three times. Why would I get another dose? And so they're waking up to the fact that this is not all it's cracked up to be. And it's interesting what you're observing. You know, I'm also observing that, you know, large businesses, institutions, and small businesses, especially small businesses in our area, I've seen pharmacies who are, you know, doing half days, cafes who have closed for the afternoon because all the staff are off sick, things we never used to see. But the issue with teasing out what the causal factors behind that is the same as long COVID versus long vaccine injury. You can hide a litany of evils and crimes by saying, well, of course we've got all these sick people. It's repeated COVID. It's long COVID.
So yeah, but they said you wouldn't get it if you took this.
Yeah, but of course they backtrack from that. First of all,
I know they modified it.
Modified. And now pretty much all that's left is it will protect you from long COVID. And now there's some very big population-wide studies coming out countering that last remaining reason to get the jab.
Will you be, or do you have plans to interact with this commission of inquiry? What are your plans here?
Oh, Paul, I have plans to be their worst nightmare.
Ah, good.
They are going to be sick of the sound and the sight of me in the coming year. For phase one, of course, irrespective of the fact that they didn't want to hear from me, they didn't want to hear about vaccine injury and mandates, we still submitted a 1,200-page submission. And I am going to be making as many applications as I can for a personal appearance for myself. But more importantly than that, I want a situation where there is an open room, televised or, you know, online in some way, with hundreds of mRNA injured people able to testify. And so that's what I'm after in this process. That's what I'm asking for. That's what I will be pressuring for. Interestingly, going back to the Bell Gully article, these are their words. It says, intention to move the process back towards a more traditional hearing-centric mode of receiving evidence, more like a court process. It appears formal hearings and formal presentations of evidence is likely to be a feature. So they're talking about the likelihood of phase two being an open, transparent process, large rooms, public scrutiny, people sitting in the room or televised in some way. Cameras. Yep. Phase one was all quietly behind closed doors. The public barely even knew it was happening.
And I think the findings are due in 2026. That's an election year.
Yes, interesting. Isn't it?
Because that will define how the politicians respond. They'll make a call. If they think that they're going down in flames, they'll probably be agreeable with some of the findings that we hope to expect. Otherwise, their political careers are done. They're over because we'll know who's been associated, who didn't speak up, whatever. It's going to be really interesting in that year to see how they respond.
I have hope, Paul. There's been a lot of cynicism from freedom people in the last 3 weeks since the announcements of phase two. Look, it's what we've worked hard for. It was a make or break thing for NZ First. They invoked the agree to disagree clause with their coalition partners over this. I am moving forward with a positive frame of mind. Look, it's what, a lot of it is what we've pushed for, and now we have to stop whinging and start working to turn this into a silk purse.
I agree with you on that, and I've said this before in RCR, what do people think about what I think, but no matter how this comes out, things will come out, and that will determine what happens next. So even if the final outcome isn't here, there will be one following from here. I don't think there'll be any place to hide. I really don't.
There will be one, and I think that this can almost guarantee that we're not going to see a Labour government returning to power at the next election. Even if we get nothing else from this, we get that.
Okay, Linda, are you ready to fight?
Are you ready to go, Linda?
Yeah, watch out, Linda's coming. Watch out. And you will take no prisoners, right? And because you can't. You can't in these situations.
Look, do you know what? People call me naive, and perhaps I am, although I'm not sure I'm still naive after the last 4 years. But I truly believe that if you just do this work one day at a time underpinned with values and truth and integrity, and ultimately, in the big picture, it makes you unstoppable. And the truth will always out. It just cannot be hidden.
I hope you don't mind me telling you this. Maybe Rodney's told you. I've told Rodney. I was working at the platform at the time when he interviewed you on the platform. Do you remember that interview?
Oh, do I ever? I remember that for the rest of my life.
I was walking home from work through Courtney Place on a drizzly, southerly morning, listening to that. And I tell you, Linda, it's one of the most incredible, most powerful things I've ever heard on the radio, ever. I was tearing up. It was incredible. And I'm mentioning this because it was at that moment that I thought, I'm never going to let this go until it's run through. I'll do my bit. So thank you for that.
Wow.
That was mind-blowing. It was, I'm telling you.
I
know good radio. I've been around for a while.
Well, that was the amazing Rodney and the incredible courage of all those people who spoke to him that day. We had bereaved parents and we had seriously injured people.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was the interview that marked Rodney's parting of the ways.
Yep,
with
I knew that would happen.
As well.
Yeah. And mine.
And yours. So
ultimately,
that was a turning point. And we're so grateful that you jumped ship and here you are on Reality Check Radio.
There you go. Okay.
Working for the truth.
Just wanted to say that. All right, well, this won't be our last chat before all this goes through. Great that you came on this morning. Thank you so much for the work that you do. Let's keep in touch. Let's talk again. And I don't want to say keep our fingers crossed. We shouldn't have to do that. But let's hope that, the universe delivers for us here.
Yeah, let's do that, Paul. Thank you so much. Talk again.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.